Coming up on today's show,
a couple of guys from the label were saying, look, we can make you into the next Mexican Celine Dion if you want, and we can get you some songwriters and get you a band. Meanwhile, I'm sitting there, I'm in the band.
Welcome to another new episode of Now Hear This Entertainment, featuring interviews with guests who are having success in entertainment, primarily music. I am Bruce Wozniak, talking to guests who are singers, songwriters, musicians, recording artists, and more from the worldwide music community. Get in touch with me by writing to podcast@nhte.net, or instead of email, you can DM me through the @NowHearThisEntertainment Instagram account. Joining me today on the Now Hear This Entertainment guest line from Cape Cod, Massachusetts, my guest is a singer, songwriter, guitar player who began performing professionally at the age of just 15 years old. He is a co-founder of the band The Size, who were signed to Virgin Records and toured with such artists as the Gin Blossoms and the Spin Doctors. As a solo artist, last year my guest released a 10-song album, which he did with an Oscar-winning songwriter and producer. At the time of this episode's release, my guest will be performing as part of a 5-week tour all throughout Germany after having performed in August in Los Angeles. You've been hearing a song of his called Burn That Kingdom. Welcome to Now Hear This Entertainment, Robert LaRoche.
Bruce, nice to be with you.
Same, Robert. Thank you. Thanks for making time to talk with me today, especially given the international, I was going to say challenge, but the international blessing.
Well, I've got my suitcase out, and I think I've thrown a hoodie and a garment bag so far in the suitcase. So I have some work to do still, but I've done this quite a few times, so I kind of got it down.
Well, let's start first by having you tell the audience all about the song of yours that was just playing called Burn That Kingdom.
Right. Burn That Kingdom. That's track number 2 off my current CD, which is called Forevermore. It's on OMAD Records out of New York City. You mentioned in your intro the Oscar-winning producer, and his name's John DeNicola, and he produced the record, and we recorded at his studio in upstate New York. That is just a classic breakup song, really. When I write songs, I like to leave some room for the listener to kind of, you know, apply it to their own life. But basically, the songs are pretty much all autobiographical. And so that is a breakup song. And, building up a little empire, whether it be an empire of amour, you know, or, you know, a business empire, whatever it is, and having that, you know, break down and then sort of being on the outside looking in is sort of what that song's about.
But could a listener interpret that into a business relationship breakup? Because when you said empire, that's what I thought of is, maybe someone takes a spin on it of when they listen to it and go, you know, this sounds like me and my business partner and what we went through.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a lot of truth to that, too. Yeah. I would say definitely on that. Sure.
Robert, I'm always fascinated when I talk to a songwriter and he or she can remember as though it was yesterday. They can say, oh, I'll tell you exactly where I was, Bruce, when I wrote that song. Can you remember where you wrote Burn That Kingdom?
I remember being on tour. I believe we were in Austria. And I remember, you know, having the basic chord structure and the melody. And that song, I believe, was written, started in Velden, Austria, which is in the southeast corner of Österreich, of Austria, an area called Carinthia. Beautiful, gorgeous area. And, you know, some songs come very quickly, some come all at once. This took time. This had to really sit, and I had to, you know, I normally try not to force songs. I kind of let them force me, meaning they keep recurring over and over and over in my head until finally they drive me crazy to where I have to either pick, you know, play piano or guitar, usually guitar, And that song was started in Velden, Austria.
But was it a case of, because it sounded like you said, and I want to get this straight from you, it sounded like you said you had chord progressions, you had melodies. So did that come first and the lyrics later? And then for that matter, is that your typical pattern that you've noticed about your own songwriting, or was this kind of different from what usually takes place?
Right. It's a good question. The answer is yes and yes. Normally, for me, Bruce, I usually hear a melody, a vocal melody first, and then I'll flush out the chords. Occasionally, if it's a riff-driven song, I'll come up with the guitar part first and then put a melody over it. Normally, it's the other way around. I hear a melody, sometimes driving, sometimes first thing in the morning, I wake up, what's this? This is interesting. This is something new. And then I kind of let it sit and simmer. You know, I would not describe myself as a technical person, but I do know enough to record ideas on my iPhone. This is one of the great things about technology is that if I have a melody or a chord progression, I immediately record it so I don't forget it. But generally speaking, music first, lyrics second. Not always, but generally.
I have two follow-ups, and the simpler one I will ask first because it's going to be a short answer. But way back in the day, when you would have a song idea and there wasn't such a thing as a smartphone, what did you run to then so that you could preserve that? Were you literally writing down C, 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 D, D, back to C? Or how would you write the melody to remember it when you did eventually get to a recording studio?
Right. Well, I mean, your description of it is accurate. I would write a chord chart out. However, chord charts don't, that's for the guitar or piano. Remembering the melody, that is a different animal. So, you know, in 1982, right, when the Psy's first single came out, She's Not the Girl I Used to Know, that had to be done by memory.
Wow.
And in 1982, my memory was, I would say, considerably better than it is in 2024. So it really was memory driven.
Okay. The longer question that I was going to ask you in follow up was, since you are such a long time guitar player, when it comes to songwriting, you would think, the general public would think, oh, I bet you he's always thinking guitar first. Is that the case, or is it no, as a songwriter, you do figure out how to separate being a player from, I need to just write a song now and not focus on, I want everything to be guitar driven. How have you kind of rationed that out over the years?
Right. It's the latter. It's normally put your guitar chops, machismo side of being a lead guitar player, put that to the side a little bit and focus more on the structure of the song, which is, you know, chord driven, which is driven by the chords. You can then, in the recording studio, play some very tasty guitar lines over that, no problem. But generally speaking, you got to build the song, the foundation of the song, at least can only speak for myself, is generally chord driven. You know, of course, you turn on the radio and you listen to, classic rock and Misty Mountain Hop by Led Zeppelin is the down, 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 down. I mean, that's obviously a riff-driven song, you know. But, you know, at this point in my career, I'm pretty much doing more singer-songwriter stuff. I do love Led Zeppelin, though.
But I like that description that you just gave because it helps the audience to understand that it's not a case of we're not going to do that. It's just we're not just going to do it now. We'll do it later. It's kind of like telling a little kid, I know you want dessert, and I'm not saying you can't have dessert, but we got to have soup first, and then we have our main course, and then you'll have the dessert. So we'll get to the guitar once we get in the studio, but right now we got to get the whole song put together.
That's funny. That's pretty much how it is for my solo work. It does vary with a couple of, you know, my other longtime projects that I do. And, you know, when I'm working with my partner, Patricia Vaughn, it's been 26 years. We write a lot of songs together, and that's a different animal. There's riff-driven songs that we've written and over the years that we perform live on tour. And so that is a little bit of a different approach, I guess you could say, to songwriting.
I see.
When I'm writing for her, even the Psy's for that matter, is more coming at it from more of a rock perspective. My solo stuff is, you know, basically singer-songwriter, I think. Roots rock, singer-songwriter.
Which is probably refreshing for you to have that variety at your fingertips.
it's wonderful. I'm so lucky. I mean, I have for many years. I mean, I have three different projects I can write for. Okay, the size at this point is, you know, it's not like we're scattered all over the country, and it's not as though we're an active band per se. Although we did just record a Christmas song for OMAD Records, is doing a Christmas compilation. And even though we're not in geographically close anymore, because America is a big country, and you know, we just recorded all our parts separately, but it is the four guys, it is the band members, and definitely sounds like us. So we just recently finished that, a Christmas song for OMAD Records is putting out a Christmas compilation pretty soon, I think next month. If I'm not mistaken.
Well, I must say that even though this show has gotten guests from a wide variety of genres and locales, my cup does not runneth over with people from Holyoke, Massachusetts. So tell us about growing up there, as well as for people who are listening from far, far away from the northeast of the U.S. so that they have some reference point. Tell us about growing up there, as well as how far it is from Boston.
Sure, sure. It was a great place to grow up. Holyoke is in western Massachusetts. It's about, I guess, 90 minutes down the Mass Pike to Boston. So it's not so far from Boston. It's a small state, really, Massachusetts. And it was a great place to grow up. It was a, you know, working class town. There was a lot of, it was known for manufacturing of paper, paper goods. And that was its sort of economic engine for, you know, decades. That's why my grandfather emigrated from Montreal.
Wow.
Because the word got back, you know, that there were jobs to be had working in the paper mills. It was one of the first planned industrial planned cities. It was run on hydraulic water power. So there's a three-tier canal system in the city, and it was called the, and still is called, the paper city capital of the world. You know, unfortunately, as the years went on, and what happens with a lot of those, this is a familiar story, is, you know, in the, okay, in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, 70s, it was still, I guess around the 80s, the companies started, you know, going for cheaper, less expensive labor, which meant going down south and southern states of America, and then eventually to Mexico. And I think now if you buy a notepad, or at least the last one I bought, I wasn't there that long ago, said made in Brazil.
Oh, my.
So, you know, that happens. That is, I guess, a normal progression, cost-cutting measures. But unfortunately, those jobs are largely gone now, those paper manufacturing jobs. There's still some activity, but it was an absolute powerhouse back in the day. Great place to grow up.
And my trivia about Holyoke, Massachusetts, is I remember when I was at the start of my teens, and my dad would take me to minor league baseball games in Buffalo, New York, and I'm pretty sure that the AA baseball team used to play against a team from Holyoke. So that's the only reason I've heard of that city before.
The Holyoke Millers.
Ah,
I used to go to the games myself.
That's what it was. I couldn't remember the team nickname. There you
go. Holyoke Millers. They used to play at McKenzie Field. That's the same field where when I went to high school, I ran track in high school. It's the same field that they had a you know, track events. And in the wintertime, they would flood part of it into an ice skating rink. I'm talking about 1966, 67, being 3 years old, I grew up on ice skates, you know, so. Holyoke was a great place to grow up. It had a diversity also, ethnic diversity, predominantly an Irish town, but there was, you know, Polish enclave, certainly a Franco-American, you know, French-Canadian enclave, which I was part of, and, you know, Hispanic, large Puerto Rican population. So it had a lot of diversity and was the kind of place, at least to my memory, that you learned to get along with people. You had to get along with folks, you know, and embrace the diversity, I guess would be the best way I remember it, you know, and we did.
While we're talking about your boyhood, I mentioned this in the intro and just got to ask about it. You began performing professionally at the age of 15.
Yes, I had a wonderful singing partner, my friend Michael. We were just texting the other day about J.D. Souther's passing, because we liked his music a lot. And a wonderful singer, Michael Jackowski, still is a good singer, but he chose a different path. He was smart. He didn't choose the music business. And but he was a fine singer. He had a beautiful high voice, and we were both heavily into the Everly Brothers. So at 15 years old, we weren't working in bars yet. We were doing state fairs, talent shows, the local Elks Club, or you know, whatever, you know, the Eastern States Exposition Fair, we played there.
Wow.
And it was just one acoustic guitar and two vocals. But where we really got a lot of work was, strangely, was weddings, was the big one. Mm. And we did an awful lot of weddings in the Catholic Church. You know, we would be in the back of the church, way high up where the pipe organ was. Beautiful church. Our Lady of Perpetual Help is, I'm a Catholic school guy, you know, Catholic school kid. And we did a lot of weddings there. And, you know, by professional meaning, you sing and get paid.
Yeah.
And that's my definition of, that's still now, all these years later, my definition of professional. You perform and get paid. And so we were busy. We kept pretty busy. And normally we would do Let It Be Me by the Everly Brothers, Devoted to You was another great one. These are all the Boudlow and Felice Bryant, husband and wife, great songwriting team that, you know, wrote those early Everly Brothers hits. And trying to think what else. It was a Catholic, you know, mostly in a Catholic church, so I'm sure there were some other bit more religious tinged, trying to think off the top of my head.
That's a lot, though. That's a lot of work for only being 15. Congratulations. That's great.
We were good, man. We were good at it. We were good at it. And, you know, when you're in the back of these big, beautiful churches, we didn't even have microphones, but you could hear it. It was booming. You could hear it, you know,
wow.
And the acoustics are so great. And wherever you go, I shall follow. It just came to me. Wherever you go, I shall go. I guess that's not so religious, but and then what was the obligatory one we did for weddings was He is now to be among you at the call. What was the name of that?
Oh, There is love.
I guess there is love.
Yeah.
And of course, everybody wanted that at their wedding, and we were happy to oblige.
So cool.
We get like $50 a man, which, you know, in 1979, that was pretty good.
Yeah, and when you're only 15.
Yeah, absolutely.
A quick look at a couple upcoming tour dates of mine. Folks, this Friday night, October 11th, I will be in Dawson Springs, Kentucky. If you are hearing this in time and you or someone you know are or will be in that area, come out to the West Dawson Music Venue for a show featuring three Nashville songwriters. I will be there and would love to meet you. At the start of December, I will be out west speaking at the Las Vegas Writers Retreat. If you or someone you know are a writer, and this is literature, not music, get in touch with me and I will point you to the registration page for that event so you can attend that and learn from me as well as from a publisher, a movie producer, someone who's going to talk about audiobooks and more. Next week, I will have new tour dates for you as well. I would love to meet you somewhere out on the road to thank you personally for listening to Now Hear This Entertainment. Robert, I mentioned in the intro, you mentioned them quickly, but I mentioned in the intro that you co-founded The Size. Share with the audience about that project and all that you ended up doing with that band.
Well, that was my real passion. That was I was quite young when I started that. I was 18. And I got myself a Rickenbacker 1966 330 Rickenbacker, which I still have and I still use. And we were just influenced by, you know, sort of jingle jangle rock and roll, I guess you could say. We were into the Birds and, yeah, all the early 60s stuff, you know. And it was myself and Tommy Pluta, who was playing drums back then. He wound up becoming the bass player years later. He's a multi-instrumentalist. And then, yeah, we had several bass players over the years. We were predominantly a trio at the beginning. And we were just kids. I mean, I was the oldest. I was 18, and we were playing a lot. We were playing a lot of bars in Western Massachusetts. Mm. In those days, there weren't so many. We weren't doing too many original songs. We actually had a vinyl 45 that we had released, self-released, of course, and got that to, you know, a bunch of radio stations.
Wow.
And it's funny, really, looking back on it now. I was just naive, of course, to the music business. I remember sending these off to like A&M Records, Capitol Records, and I still have a bag of a bunch of rejection letters. Some of them quite thoughtful. You know, some are just standard, not looking for a new, you know, not yeah. interested or whatever. But some of them you can tell they actually listened to it.
Interesting.
And said, yeah, this is good. You know, we're going to pass for now, but please send us anything else in the future. And we thought that was pretty cool, but we managed to get a lot of airplay, you know, regionally in Western Mass.
Wow.
And a little bit in Eastern Mass. And
wow.
It's funny, really, because we were just, you know, we were just kids. We were just going for it. But mainly we were doing cover songs.
Okay.
Yeah, some quite tasty cover songs, I think. We were into the Ramones and the Who, and trying to think what else was around during that time. But pretty songs that I still would enjoy listening to today. And, you know, this would have been the end of 81, going into 82. And we were working a lot, and mainly on weekends. In those days, a lot of times you would do, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday night in the same club. So you'd set up your stuff on Thursday and break it down Saturday night. And we got a pretty good following. And, you know, in that area around my hometown of Holyoke, there's a lot of colleges. There's a lot of gigs. There's a lot of, they were looking for bands. So you had, University of Massachusetts, pretty big school, Amherst College, couple of really good women's colleges. Of course, these are all still in existence. Smith College, I'm referring to. Mount Holyoke, of course, we played there. Hampshire College. So there were gigs, you know, and we hustled. You know, we weren't passive. We went for it. And we played a lot and got a little better, a little better. Started bringing in more original material and more, and, you know, added a fourth member eventually. And
yeah, what was that originally intended to be a duo and grew into a band? Because the way I read it, it looked to me like there were two of you that co-founded it. Or is it just, no, we were the co-founders, but we weren't a duo?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Tommy and I got that ball rolling. And, you know, we're still thick as thieves, Tommy and I. We're best friends. And he's also on OMAD Records. We're on the same label. He's got his solo stuff's really good, too. And no, we intended it to be, you know, rock and roll band.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Well,
100%.
Since I included this back in the intro when I referenced the success of the size, take us to June 1991 and the significant development for the band, including how that opportunity came to be.
Right. Well, that was a great year. When I look back on that, that was just a year where everything was clicking. You know, we had already been the size working for 10 years at this point. It had already been for years an all original show. You know, we were older, and gone were the days of doing, you know, I Want to Be Sedated by the Ramones, which I still love, but it was an original project, of course. And we started playing in New York City on a regular basis. Wasn't so far, maybe 3 hours from Holyoke, 2.5, depending on who was driving. And, you know, we started playing a place called the China Club, which was on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, 75th and Broadway is where it was. Yeah, China Club was like this legendary, they had them everywhere, right? New York, LA, Chicago, all the big cities, Vancouver. And it was like a, God, those kind of places are gone now. It was like a velvet rope thing you know, they'd have 200 people waiting to get in and the doorman, you know, would select you, and then the other people have to wait. So it was always packed. And the show went down really, really well. And I think we were just playing for an hour maximum. We'd go in and play for an hour. And so we started playing there in 89, 90, 91. We got started to get popular, and then the gentleman that booked the club was a fellow named Tommy Allen. Great drummer, great guy, and he was the talent booker. He booked the bands at the China Club, and he in turn was in a production company. He had a partner named John DiNicola, and they had a production company called OMAD, OMAD, stands for Ordinary Madness. And what they were doing was looking for talent, young bands, to sign a deal with them, take them into the studio, and then in turn shop that around to record companies. That's exactly what happened. And Tommy Allen loved the band, and he got his partner John DeNicola to come to see the band one night. He loved it. This would have been in 1990, and about a year went by, and they took us into the Hit Factory, in great studio in New York, and they produced these demos, which were then demos. And they shopped them around. So I remember being in meetings with Sony and Capitol, and we wound up signing with Virgin Records. They had a subsidiary called Charisma, and we were signed by a really great guy, recently passed away. He was a really good guy. Phil Cordero was his name. Legendary guy in the music business. Italian guy from Brooklyn. Very street. Very, very, very engaging gentleman. And he came out to see us at the China Club. And then he brought his staff out again to the China Club. And then he brought even more staff to see us at CBGB's.
Wow.
And I'll never forget the night at CBGB's. This would have been in early 91, where, you know, he was already into it, but I guess we did well enough to impress the rest of the people that worked for him at Virgin. And I'll never forget him coming up to us, shaking our hands, and goes, "Welcome aboard, guys, welcome aboard." And we're like, okay, we got, this is looking good. So we actually signed the deal in June of 1991. And as I say, it was OMAD Productions that got us the deal. And so, yeah, we signed in June of 91. And then 2 months later, in August, we were in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I was going to say June of 91. And then a couple months later, this kid from Holyoke, Massachusetts, ends up out west at a place that I imagine you dreamed about back when you did begin performing at the age of 15. Tell the audience what I'm referring to from August 91 and where you got to go to.
Right. Well, the label decided, first of all, they had to decide on a producer. That was the big decision at that time. The band members, we weren't that involved in that process, to be honest. First of all, we didn't have a say in it. But I remember sitting down in a big, beautiful high-rise with the band, and they talked about, okay, we need to get your producer, and we're thinking about this guy, thinking about this guy. And they brought in a really cool guy named Jody Stevens, and he was the drummer for Big Star, which was a real pet band for me that I loved them. Alex, that was Alex Shilton, and they had the song September Girls, and he was a great guy, and we were like, yeah, he'd be good. And, you know, they had mentioned, threw some other names around, and they hadn't made a decision. And sort of at the 11th hour, John DeNicola said, well, I'm neighbors in Greenwich Village, in the West Village. I'm neighbors with Ed Stasium. I know him. I've seen him walking his dog or at a, just in the neighborhood. I know the guy. And Ed Stasium did all the Ramones stuff. He did, his very first job was engineering Midnight Train to Georgia, Gladys Knight and the Pips. That came out pretty good. And he was really hot, Bruce, at that time. He had done Living Color, Smithereens, Soul Asylum, Jeff Healey. It's like he was hot.
Wow.
Great producer, amazing. And so John approached Ed, and the label went crazy. Like, you can get Ed Stasium? He said, yeah, but he's not coming to New York. We have to go to Los Angeles because he lives in L.A. So if you want Ed, you got to fly the band out to L.A. He wants to record at A&M Studios, which is at the old Charlie Chaplin soundstage. So you're talking about a pretty big monetary investment.
Yeah.
And they went for it. The label said, no, we're going to do that. So, you know, all of a sudden we had plane tickets. All of a sudden, we had house keys to a condo in L.A., and we were recording 5 days a week at A&M Studios. I got to meet, I didn't get to meet Herb Albert, but I met Jerry Moss, and, you know, they said, come on in, guys, and we, it was mind-blowing. I mean, we recorded in Studio A, where they did We Are the World. That was where we recorded. And,
so cool.
You know, we, in hindsight, we could have made a whole lot cheaper record in New York, just banged it out in 2 weeks at the Record Plant or at the Hit Factory. But in those days, we weren't questioning business decisions.
That's right.
You know, we
That's
were
right.
just so thrilled to be what we thought could have been, you know, a priority act for them.
Yeah, so cool. I'm joined today on the Now Hear This Entertainment guest line from Cape Cod, Massachusetts by singer, songwriter, guitar player Robert LaRoche. Visit his official website at robertlarochemusic.com. I will have a link to it on the show page for this episode on my podcast website, nhte.net. You heard me say in the intro that last year he released a 10-song album. You heard him talking about one of the songs from it. On robertlarochemusic.com, you will see an Order Your CDs page where you can purchase his original music as well as that of the size. Look also for the Facebook and YouTube logos at the top of his website. Do also find and follow Robert on Spotify. His original music is also available on iTunes. Coming up, you will hear about a ton of live dates he is doing throughout October in Europe. There is a major update to pass along to you with regards to the Owl app that you hear me talk about each week on this show. My update for you is that the app itself has a major update that has been rolled out. If you had not already been using it, A, you will just be starting in with all the great new features and have nothing to compare it to, but B, this all makes this the perfect time to finally download it. Owl, like the bird except with two W's and two L's, is a social networking platform that connects people instantly through private one-on-one audio calls. Last week on the show, I mentioned that there is now another easy way to get at the information I have posted online about Owl, having said that I have added the Owl logo to the bottom of the weekly e-newsletter. Otherwise, on my podcast website, nhte.net, tap or click anywhere that it says news, and then look for the article under the headline, Help Now a Phone App Call Away. That article has all the details, including a link to download for free from the App Store or Google Play. Plus, it has my referral code, which is a required field when you're setting it up on your phone. Get it set up and then call me and thousands of other users on there. Robert, before all that, you were talking about 1991 and being out in Hollywood recording at legendary A&M Studios. Fast forward 7 years later, and in New York City, you join up with a band in 1998. Tell the audience about the opportunity that you got then.
Sure. Well, you're referring to Patricia Vaughn.
Yeah.
That's V-O-N-N-E. Patricia Vaughn Rodriguez is actually her name. And so I met Patricia in 1990 at that aforementioned China Club. She worked at the China Club. And she was quite young. She was 18 years old or something, and she was working there. And so we started a relationship. And this is before, you know, cell phones and texting, and we would write letters. You know, that's how we kept in contact. Write letters, funny. And so, you know, I was busy in those days. She was busy in those days. We were sort of two ships passing in the night. There was a spark. We had a connection. And so we kept in touch. Eventually, we got together as a couple. She was also a fine singer, playing guitar. And she was, you know, had her mindset that she was going to start a band in New York City. And, you know, initially, I was not so encouraging because I said, yeah, you know, the music business is tough. And it's a vow of poverty, and you know, there's a lot of letdown. Yes, of course, there's no greater buzz than getting up and playing your own songs. And that, so I said, you know, there's the facts as I know them. What's your decision? And she said, well, I'm going to do it with or without you. I said, okay, it's strong-willed and as it should be. So I decided to, okay, let's do this. So, And we got a fantastic band together in New York City. And our first gig was at CBGB's in 1998. Mm. And we got a four-year run in New York, got a really good following. She's a great networker. It was a really good band, all original show, of course. And we had record companies come out to see us. And I remember Sony. I actually remember a meeting that we had with Sony. Sony wanted to meet with Patricia, and of course I went along too. And we met with Sony and sat down at a beautiful restaurant. A couple of guys from the label were saying, look, we think you can be, because she's Hispanic, she's Latina, Mexican-American, and we can make you into the next Mexican Celine Dion if you want, and we can get you some songwriters and get you a band. Meanwhile, I'm sitting there, I'm in the band. They're saying this in front of me. So they, you know, it wasn't about feelings, or the feelings didn't come into to play. And she said, you know, I want to do my own songs, and I love my band. Mm. And they said, well, are you sure? Because, you know, you have the look and you have the X factor. She said, no, I'm sure. Thanks very much. And we had a nice dinner, and that was that. And I had said to her, you know, I kind of think 90% of people would have said, yes, I'll fire my band tonight and get me some songs and let's go in the studio. So I had a lot of respect for that. I really had a lot of respect for her for that. And we decided that she's from San Antonio, and we had gone down and played a pretty big music festival called South by Southwest. They still have
Let me jump in here, because audience, this is a curveball coming up here, because you've heard Robert tell his story about growing up in Holyoke, Massachusetts, and now you're hearing him talking about spending some time in New York, joining Patricia Vaughn's band. And sure, yeah, they went out to California, but you understand the spirit with which I'm saying is that was just to go record at A&M Studios. That wasn't him living there. So continue with the story, Robert, because there you are. You're with the Patricia Vaughn band, and all of a sudden.
Yeah. Well, by that time, I had moved to New York. I moved to New York in 94 because I was in a personal relationship with Patricia. And then, of course, the band got going. But we played South by Southwest Music Festival in Austin, Texas. Patricia's from San Antonio, and I guess, yes, we sent in an application, got selected, and we had a really great show. Flew the guys down, the New York band. It was wonderful. I'd never been there. You know, it was March in New York. It was cold and dirty snow, and then we went to Austin. It was 80 degrees, palm trees, music everywhere, like unbelievable music scene. And, you know, then we started the conversation of this might make more sense because it's a bilingual show also. You know, Patricia's show is a bilingual show.
Okay.
You know, and she was missing her family. She's from a very big family, 10 children. And she's like, well, would you consider coming down here? I said, I come down here in a heartbeat, you know. I loved New York, absolutely loved New York. But, if you know, New York's a grind. New York is not an easy place to live. It's, if you're a musician, I remember we used to have to get a car service, you know, and I lived way down in the Lower East Side. I lived below Alphabet City, which is pretty funky back in those days. And we would get the local car, Dominican car service, Uno Cinco Cinco Ridge, Uno Cinco Cinco Ridge. That was my address, 155 Ridge. And, you know, you're out $75 just getting your amp and guitars into the car service to take you to the club.
Wow.
You know, it's expensive. I love New York, but it's difficult. It's not a cakewalk. It's tough. And so we took another 2 years, but we did relocate down there. We got married, and we relocated to Austin in 01. And I've been living there since.
Well, and that resulted in 20 years of European tours with Patricia.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. That was really a beautiful thing because Patricia is multifaceted. She's not only a musician, she had a very successful modeling career, and she's also very involved in acting in front of the camera, directing behind the camera. Her brother is Robert Rodriguez. He's a well-known film director. El Mariachi, Dust Till Dawn, Desperado. So, you know, it's in the family. That creative gene is in the Rodriguez family.
20 years of European tours. I wonder, the first time you went over to Europe, did you think, oh, Europe, this will be fun, and have no idea? Or was it, hey, we're going to go there because we want to see if this is something that we could do regularly for however many years we can sustain it?
It was both. You know, we wanted to have fun. We both loved to travel. And we'd actually met a guy. What a great guy. He's no longer with us. He passed away way too young. His name was Michael Norton. Mike was a good friend of mine. And we were playing at a place, I guess it would have been in 2004. Patricia Vaughn Band was playing this on Lake Austin at this place called Carlos and Charlie's. It's long gone, but it was a cool venue. And our drummer said, you know, I know you guys were talking about you just want to find a way somehow to, you know, get into the music scene, the club scene in Europe. You see that guy sitting there with his daughter? That's who you want to talk to, because he brings bands over there. And so I said, okay, excuse me. And I went over to him, introduced myself. Great guy, real Texas guy. You know, he talked like that and everything. He had a Texas accent and beautiful guy. And he was with his daughter, who's, of course, I'm good friends with now. And she was quite young at the time. And he said, well, I was fixing to leave here in a little while, but I'll catch a couple songs. We said, oh, thanks. He wound up staying for the whole show, and he liked it very much. And yeah, so I think it was only 4 or 5 months later we did our first tour over there.
Wow.
Yeah. It's just luck.
And I think what you just described is a good lesson for anyone listening who is an aspiring performer, that someone says, I'll stick around for a couple songs. Yeah, they stayed for the whole show, which obviously tells you that it went great. But you have to realize in that moment, okay, this is our audition. This guy may potentially have work for us in Europe. So as much as you might think of it as, oh, that's great, he's going to stick around for a couple songs. No, this means, okay, I'm going to stick around for a couple songs because you're auditioning now. Let me see if I want to put my name behind you in trying to book you overseas.
I think that's spot on.
But do you think you knew that at that time, or was it, oh, cool, he's going to stay, let's dazzle him?
I think we knew it. I think we knew it. Yeah, I think we knew it. I mean, if you've ever seen the Patricia Vaughn show, it's a great show. I mean, it's, yeah, of course, I'm not objective, but, you know, we're not sitting on barstools, finger-picking, singing about grandma's porch, you know, in the fireplace. It's a rock and roll show. We're moving around. It's a physical, fun show, and it's a feel-good show. You know, it's a positive energy show, but it rocks like hell. And I think he saw that, and Patricia does have what I would call the X factor. And yeah, so it just resonated very much in Europe, and we've been all over the world with our show, and it all worked out really well.
But he books you in Europe, and what was the first country that you played in Europe?
That's a good question, man. Boy, that is, I don't think I've ever been asked that. I think it was the UK. I think it was London. Okay. We went to London first.
Okay.
I think we did some shows in the UK. We did France, we did Italy, Germany, Austria,
wow.
Poland, Scandinavia, on and on and on.
Yeah,
I mean,
I was going to say, at this point, it's more of a question of which countries have we not played in, because you've hit so many.
I mean, it's got to be over 20.
Wow.
It's got to be over 20.
Wow.
I don't think that's a stretch. You know, all these years later, so we've been doing it for 20 years. You know, we used to do 3 tours a year, and then it was 2 tours a year. And, you know, as the years have gone by, we've scaled back. We've kind of gone to the markets that respond the best to our show, because it is a business. It's very costly to tour. It's not cheap. So we've kind of focused, I would say, the last 10 years on the sort of Germanic speaking countries, Germany, Austria, Switzerland. Those seem to be the best markets for us. We've loved all the other cultures and all the other markets. It's different for other artists. I know bands that are killing it in Spain, you know, but for us, we sort of keep going back to these markets where we know we're going to have a full house.
Yeah, that makes sense. Makes sense. Now, all that having been said, though, I mentioned a couple times that a year ago you put out a 10-song album. So tell us about the Robert LaRoche solo career, including that album that you put out last year.
Right, right. Well, you know, for years and years and years, I had my original love, my original band, The Size, S-I-G-H-S. That was my baby, you know. And when that ended around 95, 96, around that time, and then I joined forces with Patricia, because we were, even before Patricia's first gig, we were already writing songs and playing together. We lived in the same building. I was on the 6th floor, she was on the 4th floor, and of course we were a couple at that time. So, you know, then I joined her project, and that went full on and still going full on. But somewhere along the line, around 2014 or so, I said, you know, I love this gig, don't want to end it, want to keep it going, you know, until I have to go out on in a wheelchair. But I miss singing. I miss being the lead singer. I miss singing, you know, my own material. And at that point, I wanted to kind of focus more on, instead of the Rickenbacker rock and roll show, playing acoustic guitar, performing live with acoustic guitar with some accompaniment. And of course, I had a batch of songs. I've always been right. I've always got songs. And I got a lot of unfinished songs on the iPhones as ideas. But, you know, I always have a lot of material. And so I decided to go into the studio, do my first solo CD, which came out in 2015. It's called Patient Man. And because of all my years of touring Europe, I knew a lot of people. I had a lot of friends and contacts and stuff. So I set up my own tour. And I wound up going with myself on acoustic guitar and vocals, contrabass, upright bass, and violin. So it's sort of an orchestral pop, orchestral. It's an unusual show. I wanted it to be different. And so I did a tour in 2015, and that went really well. And then I did another one in 2017, and that went even better. And then I had a new record out 2019, did another tour in 2019, and that went better still. It was just growing. It was building, just trying to build an audience, because people were kind of used to seeing me all those years with Patricia, just, you know, balls of the walls, rock and roll. And here I am up there, very sensitive, you know, sensitively playing, you know, my little roots rock songs. But it worked. I found an audience. And, of course, then COVID came, put everything on ice, put everything on hold. And during this time, right at the end of, like, 2020, of course, COVID was in full swing, and I'm in Austin, because I live in Austin, Texas. Then my dad got sick. He passed away in January of 21. And at that point, it was transition time for my mom. What are we going to do? You know, how are we going to care for mom? And so I made the decision, you know, with my siblings. I guess I had sort of the most flexible, you know, being a musician, and there were no gigs at the time. I had the time. So I came up here to Massachusetts, where I'm from, and I've been here ever since. I've been here over 3 years now, taking care of my mom. She's going to be 93 and pretty soon, and I've been a full-time caregiver. So that's the Massachusetts connection. But I'm lucky because I can still tour, and my siblings will take care of mommy or one of the grandchildren, or so it still allows me to go out and do my live performance arts.
Yeah, exactly. Late September and all throughout this month that we're in now, October, lots and lots and lots of live dates in Germany with Patricia Vaughn.
Right, right. Yeah, we're busy. We're busy. It's 5 nights a week, all one-nighters. It's all traveling and moving. You're constantly in motion, but I love it. I don't look at it as a chore. I kind of just make peace with the sleep deprivation. I just embrace the sleep deprivation. And I cleaned up my lifestyle some years ago. You know, I've been sober for a long time, Bruce. And, if I was partying like I was in my 20s and 30s, oh boy, I don't know if I'd be able to do a 25 dates in 5 weeks, but you know, I'm taking care of myself much better than I did when I was younger. So I'm able to do it.
Wow. 25 dates in 5 weeks. Those of you who are just starting into this business and are only seeing the glamour, he's playing all these shows in Germany, just not in this moment, but just think about that over the coming days and over the coming weeks. 25 shows in 5 weeks. That's a lot. That's a lot. And you're hearing Robert say what you have to do to yourself physically to be able to handle that and to keep up with it. Because don't forget, those people in Germany are excited that these Americans are coming over, quote unquote, for one night only, right? Because if Robert and Patricia are going from town to town, they're going, yeah, on such and such a date, October, whatever, they're going to be in our town. And you got to be giving them the best show and not looking like you've been on the road for 4 weeks or whatever it is by the time you get to that venue. So great, great lessons. We're going to close with another one of Robert's original songs, one called Steal Your Heart. Before I let you go and I play that song, Robert, share with the audience first all about this track, if you would, please.
Steal Your Heart, I wrote that in Austin at a friend of mine's apartment. It's an ex-girlfriend of mine. And the relationship you know, as a couple, didn't last that long, but the friendship has lasted a very long time, and we're very good friends. And I help her when I'm in Austin. I help her, just take care of her dog if she's got to work. I got keys to her place, and I take the dog out, walk the dog, and I keep a guitar there. And so that song kind of fell out of the sky, and I kind of wrote it about this young lady, and she was going through a difficult time, going through a bad breakup, and I just sort of just knocked that out in maybe 2 or 3 hours. With the dog, of course, he's a beautiful shepherd, half wolf, half shepherd, black, gorgeous dog, and he had a lot of energy, you know, and you had to keep an eye on him. But the funny thing is, whenever I picked up the guitar, it was a 12-string that I'd still keep it there. I hadn't been there in a while, but I keep a 12-string guitar. And every time I start playing, he calmed down. He'd lay down at my feet. He loved music. And occasionally he'd join in with, kind of moaning, you know. And he loved music. So the song is sort of a pep talk, if you will. It's a message to her, like the opening lyrics are, whatever paces they're putting you through, baby, please don't let it tangle you. When you, you know, there's, won't go so far as say it's a message song, but the lyrics speak for itself. You know, it's sort of a uplifting, like, you know, you got this, you're going to be okay.
Nice. Robert, great to meet you. Thank you for making time to be on Now Hear This Entertainment, and all the best during all that touring that you're doing throughout Germany this month. It was great to have you on Now Hear This Entertainment.
Great pleasure for me, Bruce. I appreciate it very much.
You're welcome. And with that, I will wrap up another new episode of Now Hear This Entertainment. My sincere thanks to singer, songwriter, guitar player Robert LaRoche. Do visit his official website at robertlarochemusic.com. As I said before, I will have a link to it on the show page for this episode on my podcast website, nhte.net. Once you land on his website, look for the Order Your CDs page to get Robert's original music, as well as that of The Size. Forevermore is his 10-song album that came out last year. You can also get his music from iTunes. On robertlarochemusic.com, you will see links for Facebook and YouTube. Find and follow Robert on Spotify as well. For that matter, tell him you heard him and his music on Now Hear This Entertainment. For my listeners in Germany, keep in mind that Robert will be there all this month performing with Patricia Vaughn. I do truly hope that you like this show, that you're enjoying what I'm doing every week on the Now Hear This Entertainment podcast. If you've made it all the way to the end, thank you for having stuck with Robert and I, and I'm going to assume that that means that you do like the podcast. You can take action to let me know that you appreciate the work that I do to keep making this show happen every week, every month, 10 and a half years now without missing once, by going on my podcast website, nhte.net, and then using the yellow Buy Me a Coffee logo that you will see there. This is not a sponsor. It's not affiliated with any brand or chain. It's just a fun way for you to send your support, your thanks to me, including a note that I will see when you utilize that option. You can also just head directly to buymeacoffee.com/BruceW. That's going to do it for episode 556. Thanks ever so much for listening. I'll send you out today with another song from Robert LaRoche. This is the one he just talked about. It's called Steal Your Heart. Whatever paces they're putting.